Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Navy runs on ships and people, and they need fuel, ammo, and tons of other stuff. Well, now ships are on duty around the world and some on heightened alert because of the world situation. It all highlights the importance of supplies and the supply chain. We get an update now from the Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command, Kurt Wendelken. Mr. Wendelken, good to have you back.
Hey, great to be back with you, Tom.
And there is a lot going on around the world. Tell us what the top concerns are now for the Navy relative to, say, a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, obviously the events in the Red Sea have become front and center for the Navy. There's lots of naval activity in that space. I don't think that was really on anybody's bingo card for 2024, but that's where we are, and we're supporting the fleet and a lot of allied partners engaging in those operations in the Red Sea. And we're still continuing with preparations to make sure we're ready in the Pacific. And then more broadly, NAVSUP's been working a supply chain transformation program for the last 5 years, and we're continuing forward with that as well.
And on the Red Sea, I mean, there have been dangers to shipping. And I guess before we get to the specific question there for the Navy, I was wondering, in all the years we've spoken, how does the Navy get stuff around? Is it strictly on Navy vessels, or do you use commercial vessels, maritime, or how does it work?
It's really a mix of lots of cooperation between standard road trucking, right? A really important part of our supply chain is moving material out of depots. They also could go by aircraft. And then ultimately, they're going to end up on a ship at some point and then get delivered to the Navy. So it could go on a commercial ship to a certain point. We work with Transcom as a provider of either government airlift or commercial airlift. And then what we refer to as the last tactical mile is typically done by the Navy, either by a Navy aircraft or a Navy ship will do the last tactical mile to support Navy vessels that are underway.
So just the sheer movement itself sounds like a pretty heavy logistical exercise.
It really is amazing. We sort of take it for granted because it works so well, but it only works so well because there's so many amazing people, both in the private sector and working for the government, that are making that a success.
So from depots, there might even be overseas depots.
Absolutely. And it varies by what kinds of material we're moving. But yeah, it could definitely be overseas depots where material's coming from.
And just another detail question, do things get delivered to ships at sea?
They absolutely get delivered to ships at sea, what's referred to as UNREP or underway replenishment, where another ship will come alongside the ship and they will refuel the ship while the ship is moving. And then also very often material will be brought over by helicopter while the two ships are refueling to bring stuff like food and parts and other things like that. So we absolutely get resupplied while we're underway.
Well, I've learned something. I thought only aerial refueling was the way things moving got refueled in the military.
And again, for people who are interested, I direct you to YouTube to go see some amazing videos of Navy ships getting refueled at sea.
All right. I'm going to take a look at that because my feeds do show the aircraft being done and flying that boom down into that little tiny nozzle there. So the Red Sea, what are some of the specific effects or things you're watching for right now?
You know, we're making sure that the vessels that are operating in the Red Sea have all the material that they need. And it's sort of a challenge because that's not a place where we've traditionally operated in this way for as long as I've been working with the Navy, which has been for over 30 years. So what happens is when a new area of operations opens up, then all the logisticians have to figure out, how are we getting material there? What new ways do we have to use to get our material there? What are the ports that we can use? What are the airports that we can use? And then what are the challenges of getting material to ships while they're engaged in operation? So again, I think that's a novel space that we traditionally have not resupplied in, that we've had to flex our muscles. And I think both the Navy and our joint partners like the Defense Logistics Agency have been rising to the challenge.
What's the old saying? Amateurs plan battle strategies, professionals plan logistics.
It's absolutely true, right? I hate to advertise for myself, but yeah, I think that is absolutely true.
And the South China Sea, that's been troublesome, you know, if you're the Philippines and there's been actual shooting, you know, and so forth and boardings and this kind of thing. The United States has a huge strategic interest there, the pivot to the Pacific and the whole nine yards. What's the situation there? What are some of the challenges?
So I think that's an area where we do operate traditionally. So we have more structure there to support us. But we're really taking a look to make sure that we have everything that we need in place should something occur there that requires the Navy to respond on behalf of the nation.
And what about the commercial partners that you might use in areas that are semi-contested or temporarily contested? Does that take cajoling to have them go there, or probably they have to go to the same places for their other customers?
I think it requires a slightly different way of thinking, but typically, you know, our commercial partners have been alongside with us. The last tactical mile might be the last tactical 100 miles or 500 miles, where material will get moved onto a Navy vessel or aircraft earlier to make sure we can bring that material in without placing people in undue danger.
We're speaking with Kurt Wendelken. He is the Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command. And just a couple of detail questions while we have you, getting to the supply chain itself. I just read recently that you have standardized contract language for logistical purposes, and I didn't realize that was a thing. Tell us about that initiative.
So that's part of our own internal supply chain transformation. One of the things that we really recognized as we started better conversations with our suppliers is that we had to learn to become better customers ourselves. So we discovered that some of our contracts missed some of the configuration management language that we really needed in there. And we've been cleaning up those contracts to make it easier for our suppliers to come in and do what are called requests for variances. So if there was something that needed to be changed in how we wrote the contract, we needed to make sure that we had the language in there so they knew exactly what to do. And we didn't always do that. So there's a broader Navy effort called Get Real, Get Better. And this is really us working to get real about things that we weren't doing as well as we could and try to get better. So we had the language in only 17% of our contracts in FY20. In fiscal year 23, we brought that up to 94%. And now we're up to 100% in fiscal year 24. So hats off to our contracting team for taking that critical look at how they were working with our suppliers and making things better.
Well, maybe an example of what type of variance might be called for and what would the language say roughly?
So we would ask for something in the contract. There would be a specification in the contract, and maybe the vendor would come back to us and say, hey, I can't deliver it in exactly that way. I can deliver it in this way, which we think is materially the same. Does the Navy agree? But again, it's administrivia, right? And sometimes bureaucracies get rightly criticized for making the administrivia too hard. But this is really important administrivia and really is part of us becoming a better customer with our suppliers.
In other words, you could get better value and maybe more efficiency, but for contract language.
I couldn't have said it better, right? So it's really a place where the contractor is trying to help the Navy get a better product or get something on a different timeline. And instead of just saying, no, I said it to you one time, just do what I said, it's really a two-way dialogue, which is really the way we should be working with our suppliers.
And I imagine this applies to everything from, say, crates of oranges to capstan or shaft bearings.
It can absolutely apply to everything, right? And I think back to Get Real, Get Better, it really highlights what Navy's trying to do, which is a really important way for Navy to become better and be able to support the nation better.
And you mentioned the supply chain transformation effort. That's one part of it. What are some of the big things this year?
Right now, we're really focusing on our surface combatants, which are destroyers, amphibious ships. It's not always clear to the nation what it is that the Navy does, but I think one of the great things that came out of the Red Sea is the nation has been able to see our Navy in action. So Navy's been on a journey where we started working in the aviation space, our supply chain transformation. We then moved to improve our support to submarines, and now we're working on destroyers to make sure that they have the material that they need on board in the form of spare parts, and that we're really doing as much as we can to support them, because, again, they're an important part of what the Navy can do for the nation.
So it's more of an improvement, say, in just in time or in having the resilience if something goes wrong? So
it's really both of those things. And I think, and you and I have talked about this before, COVID kind of showed us where just in time falls down, where, you know, key medical supplies, toilet paper, PPE just wasn't available because businesses had really gone to a just in time model. And what we really have to do as a Navy is we have to balance just in time with having what we need when we need it. So it's a real challenge to make sure that we're buying the right material. We use mathematical models and AI to help us do that, but we're continuing to improve that because we want to make sure we have exactly the material that the fleet needs when they need it.
Right. So you could almost anticipate needs with the right algorithms and the right data ahead of when they themselves might know.
That's exactly what we want, right? So they have a store of parts on board. So we want to make sure that they're bringing what they need, depending on what part of planet Earth they're traveling to. And then we want to make sure that we're backstopping them with more material ashore in case they need it.
Yeah, it strikes me that because the command of a ship changes regularly in maybe 18 months or whatever, and that captain is gone, NAVSUP knows the whole history of what's been going on in terms of requirements for that given vessel.
Absolutely, right? And that's a really important component for us to be able to forecast correctly. And we work very closely with the engineers at NAVSEA to make sure that we're updating those calculations with the best data that we have.
And a final question, you know, the government has done well on a percentage and dollar basis with small business. But as the Pentagon, you know, writ large has said, the number of participants from small business is going down. There's a million reasons for that. What do you hope to accomplish to get more people attracted to military business and NAVSUP?
That's a great question. The Navy writ large is really, really focused on small business. And we have a number of different programs, including a mentor-protege program, where we take a small business. We would team them with a very large defense OEM, and they would help that small business develop their business with the government. And we all have to remember, every large business started out as a small business. They're really, really critical to both our supply chain at NAVSUP, but to our larger economy in the United States.
Kurt Wendelken is Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great day.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group. so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there taking notes on the meeting and said, go ahead and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have, because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.